On this evening's agenda, we hear some good news from the Manx Utilities Chair about our 25-year-old electricity interconnector. But first, the Extradition Bill 2025 is making its way through the legislative process, and for all but a handful of people, its impact on our lives will be minimal. So why do we need this legislation? Well, according to the notes on the bill, no one should be able to escape justice simply by crossing a border, and our current extradition law relies on a largely repealed piece of dated UK legislation. The law should provide a quick and effective framework to extradite a person to the country where they are accused or have been convicted of a serious crime, provided that this does not breach their fundamental human rights. I caught up with the Minister for Justice and Home Affairs, Jane Poole-Wilson, last week as she was preparing to successfully steer the extradition bill through its third reading in the House of Keys. I began by asking her why we need the bill.
So, Phil, extradition is a legal process for a situation where somebody in one country is either wanted for prosecution or to serve a sentence in another country. And it's part of a legal landscape that applies internationally. And historically, also even to the present day, the Isle of Man has been covered by a 1989 UK Act on extradition. And so we've never had our own standalone extradition legislation. But I think as part of our evolving constitutional arrangements with the United Kingdom, but also because in the context of international law and us being an international financial centre, it's felt important that we have our own extradition legislation. So this bill, which has been working its way through the House of Keys, is that step to create our own extradition framework in the Isle of Man.
And in the past, as you've described, we were just able to extend or have UK acts extended to the Isle of Man. That seems to work when it's something complex and generally something that we don't tend to use in the Isle of Man that much, like an extradition act. So why specifically then do we need our own piece of legislation?
Yes, I think that you're absolutely right. And there are still examples where we might put in what's known as a permissive extent clause into an act of parliament in England and Wales and then extend it to us to the extent it's relevant. But the reason why it's important for us to have our own legislation on extradition is, as I said, in part an evolving constitutional development. So, for example, the 1989 legislation in the United Kingdom has now been repealed for itself. They have a more up-to-date act, a 2003 Extradition Act in the United Kingdom. And our other Crown Dependency colleagues, Jersey and Guernsey, have also put in place their own extradition legislation. And so it is natural for the Isle of Man to follow suit. In addition, in relation to this particular topic, in terms of the Financial Action Task Force, which are the body that set the recommendations against which we're assessed during our MoneyVal assessment, one of their recommendations is that each jurisdiction should have its own extradition legislation. So there are good reasons in this case why it's important to have this bill for ourselves.
And why specifically did they think that was necessary? Do you remember?
I don't think there's a. It's just one of the Financial Action Task Force recommendations, and I think it's an important way that we can show that we take those seriously, that we have progressed legislation on this topic for ourselves.
So that would have been the previous MoneyVal exercise, presumably.
Yeah, it's FATF recommendation 39, and it's definitely a way in which we can show that our technical framework, when we have our MoneyVal assessment, it's in two parts, really. It looks at our technical setup, which is our laws, our policies and our regulatory frameworks, and it looks at our effectiveness. So do these things work in practice? And I think having specific legislation that aligns with FATF recommendations obviously helps us with our technical assessment.
Do you think sometimes that we end up adopting or creating so much law that it becomes more difficult for us to identify where things are going wrong in terms of financial crime?
Well, no, I think, I mean, you know, in simple terms, if somebody was wanted to be extradited at the moment, those things would still happen. They would just happen under 1989 outdated UK legislation that it doesn't even apply for itself. And we would have the layer of complexity that we would have to do everything through the United Kingdom. So I think in a world of evolving financial crime, where we're seeing transnational financial crime becoming an increasing threat for the Isle of Man, it absolutely makes sense that where there are cases that might involve cross-border financial crime, and the Isle of Man may either be involved in having someone extradited to another country, or indeed seeking to extradite someone here to face justice, that we have our own framework that we're able to execute.
It's quite a lengthy bill. I did glance through it myself. Much, though, of what's included in the bill is effectively dusting down, maybe updating a little bit, but taking what was in the old 1989 bill, or Act, I should say, and putting it into one of ours. Or did I miss something really important?
I think actually the history behind this legislation is that actually the 1989 legislation is considerably out of date, and a number of reviews have taken place in the United Kingdom, which is why they updated their own legislation to the 2003 Act. So actually our legislation is based on that more updated 2003 Act, as well as looking at the Jersey and Guernsey legislation. The other thing we know about the Jersey legislation is that there have been a couple of extradition matters. So we know the legislation has been tested from that perspective. So we haven't updated a 1989 piece of legislation. We've actually taken on board the developments since then, and our legislation is up to date in that sense. But also, I think importantly, it's legislation that has been tested elsewhere.
So let's suppose somebody in the Isle of Man decides that they've worked out a way to, fiddle some financial system or other, and they get caught out, and somebody in Germany takes a prosecution. What happens in terms of the process? How can that person be extradited, first of all, and how does that whole process work?
So for your listeners, I'll try not to delve into the vast amounts of detail, because you're right, the bill is a lengthy bill. It's 137 clauses. But in essence, what would happen is a territory, so you mentioned Germany, but whatever the other country is, would make a request for extradition, and then it would start a process here. And the process begins with the Attorney General checking that the request is valid. If it is valid, it then moves into our judicial process here. It's very important to say that extradition is in large part a judicial process. So it would go to the High Bailiff, an arrest warrant or a provisional arrest warrant can be issued, and then there's an extradition hearing. And the legislation sets out very specifically what the High Bailiff must do as part of that hearing. So it involves looking at whether the request is valid, and there are tests in the legislation for that. And it also looks at whether there are any bars to extradition, and they are set out in the legislation. One of those bars, for example, is double jeopardy, where you can't be prosecuted for the same crime twice. But there are other bars, such as what are known in the bill as extraneous considerations. So the question there is there an ulterior motive, if you like, for the extradition? For example, somebody's gender or race or politics or religion. So there are a series of questions the High Bailiff must ask. That includes human rights considerations. And once the High Bailiff has answered all of those questions and determines an extradition is in order, it is then finally referred back to the Attorney General, who has some final checks to make, one of which is to assess whether or not the individual might be subject to the death penalty if they were to be extradited. But once the Attorney General determines that the extradition can go ahead, the Attorney General would make the extradition order, and then there is a period of 2 months within which the extradition must take place. I think the other thing I would emphasise is throughout the bill, there are opportunities for appeal. I mean, obviously, extradition is a very serious matter, And so an individual who is subject to a potential extradition order has the right to appeal at various stages against decisions that are being made, as does the what's known as the designated territory, so the country that is seeking the extradition. If they disagree with perhaps the decision here that the person shouldn't be extradited, they can also appeal. And that appeal would involve an appeal to our High Court and ultimately to the Privy Council in England and Wales on particular matters.
And of course, crucially, one of the tests that I think it would be at the High Bailiff level that would have to be passed is the country has to be a safe country. It has to be a country considered to be a country that you are going to get a fair trial in.
Yeah, so I think you're right. Extradition, with the Isle of Man in our legislation, we haven't come up with the list of countries with whom we have extradition arrangements. That is governed by various international treaties, to which the Isle of Man plays a part through the United Kingdom. And in our bill, we have two types of countries listed in the schedule, Part 1 territories and Part 2 territories. And the process slightly differs according to which type of country. It's also possible within the bill for there to be special extradition arrangements put in place with a country that might not be listed. But again, that would be done via the United Kingdom. And there are going to be considerations such as, whether or not the United Kingdom would enter into an international treaty on extradition grounds. Indeed, one of the amendments we saw in the House of Keys during the clauses stage was to remove Zimbabwe from our bill because that is currently removed from the list of designated territories for the United Kingdom.
One of the things, and this shows what sort of a legislative nerd I am. I seem to remember thinking this at the time that it was out for consultation, but maybe I'm confusing another bill. There's no actual extradition in place or legislation in place for the Republic of Ireland. Now, is that because of the common travel area?
So actually in our bill, because we're creating our own extradition framework, one of the things that is being repealed actually is not only the application of the 1989 England and Wales legislation, but also I think it's a 1960s arrangement we have with the Republic of Ireland. So our arrangements within the United Kingdom and Ireland will be around the backing of warrants, which has been a long-standing way in which we would deal with matters that transcend our territory within our home nations, if I were to put it that way.
Okay. And the bill is progressing nicely through the House of Keys. It's expected, is it third reading that is the next stage that you'll be at?
Yes, so we're talking on Tuesday, and so we'll be going into the House of Keys, and I'll be moving the third reading of the bill in the Keys sitting.
And then off to Legislative Council, where it may spend a couple of months, and then it'll go for royal assent.
Well, yes, and I've actually been really pleased because I've tried to seek engagement not only with Keys colleagues but also Legislative Council colleagues, because I recognise this is a technical bill, and whilst it may be legislation we won't use very often, when we do have to use it, it's obviously important that the legislation works. So I've been very pleased to engage with members of Legislative Council so far over the summer to talk through the bill, hear any queries and questions. So I am hopeful that when they come to exercise their scrutiny, we will have already managed to talk through a number of points, and that they will be also satisfied, and the bill can make a decent passage through the Legislative Council as well.
So once passed, this'll help when it comes to the Moneyval inspection. How is that going? How are preparations for that going on?
Yes, so there's a lot of work already been undertaken and plenty of work still underway and to go. But actually, we're doing really well. The work is you know, it involves regulators, agencies within government, but also critically the private sector, because a big part of our work is the national risk assessment process. And that has been going on. That's involved the compilation of a lot of data and analysis, and then the publication of our national risk assessment documents. So it's with huge thanks, actually, to private sector organisations working with agencies and regulators that we are making good progress with that work. And then there will be a lot of activity in 2026 as we gear up and prepare for in-country training and preparation of our case studies and other evidence to showcase not only our technical framework, which I touched on earlier, but our effectiveness, that we understand our risk and how well we're managing it.
And all this matters, just to remind the listener, because...
It matters because the island is an international financial centre, and therefore we do act in line with international standards. I mentioned the Financial Action Task Force that set a number of recommendations and then assess us against our technical frameworks and our effectiveness. And so it matters that we are able to showcase that we have good technical laws, policies and frameworks, and that we can show effectiveness. It matters because deficiencies, if we are found deficient, then we could end up in enhanced follow-up. But what we do not want is to be found deficient and then grey-listed. That would have a risk of significant impact for our GDP. The International Monetary Fund says that grey-listing can have a 7.6% impact on GDP. But our own internal assessment is that for us as an international financial centre, that would be worse. I think the other reason it matters is for our reputation. You know, the island has promoted itself and continues to promote itself as a reputational, a jurisdiction with a strong reputation for effective regulation, where we want good business to come and thrive.
And finally, we've heard a lot of talk recently in the UK about the possibility of reducing significantly the number of trials by jury. First of all, I suppose, is that something that's being considered here? I presume you'd need to wait to find out what actually is announced before you're in a position to consider that. And then secondly, there was an order went through Tynwald in last month's Tynwald connected to juries. And I was just wondering, is there any link?
No. So I think the UK's position, as far as I understand it from what's being reported, is very much to do with the backlog in their criminal justice system. We are fortunate, I think, in the Isle of Man that we have not got those backlogs. Having said that, I think it is important that the justice system works as efficiently and effectively as possible for all stakeholders, particularly victims. And so we do continue to look. There's a piece of legislation that I'm sure we can talk about as it gets ready to come forward to the Keys in due course, which is our justice reform legislation. And that is about operating our own courts of justice as efficiently and effectively as possible. But the work we do here is very much tailored to our needs. In terms of the jury order that came through in November, Tynwald, that was actually to update the schedule to our Jury Act, which hasn't been updated for 40 plus years. And as things stood, there were lots of automatically excluded categories of individuals who just would not be eligible at all for jury service. But I think in the modern age, when it's particularly important that a jury is comprised of a representative group of the island, I think the view was that it was much, much better to remove all of those automatic exclusions for swathes of people based on professional grounds, and instead have a wider pool of people to draw from, but also allow for people to apply for exemption on a case-by-case basis, because it is recognised, you know, if there is due to be a lengthy trial, and perhaps you're a midwife or someone who, or you're self-employed, and it would be far too detrimental either for the community or for your business to commit to a several month trial, that you should be able to still apply for an exemption. And that's what the jury order does. It creates a bigger pool, but it still allows for people to apply to the general registry for an exemption.
That was MHK for Middle, Jane Poole-Wilson. In November, Tynwald Manx Utilities Authority Chair John Wannenberg's tail was wagging. You had some positive things to say in answer to a question I think the question, what was it? It was around the use of the interconnector
and green energy.
Yeah. So Mr. Morehouse was asking more about green imports for the green energy tariff, which is for the commercial sector. And that is growing year on year. In fact, it's more than doubled from 22 to 25. So that tells us that it's becoming more and more important to companies that they use green energy going forward. And we are happy at the UMUA to, you know, to cater for their demand. We have something which we call the Renewable Energy Guarantee of Origin, where we source the energy from, be it a wind farm or a solar display in the UK, and we block that part off, and it comes and it's used for that company. Much like for domestic users, when they use, if they want lamb from New Zealand or lamb from wherever, we can trace it back. And that's becoming more and more important. And that is done through the interconnector. And the interconnector, last month in October, it celebrated its 25th anniversary. So we've done a little synopsis of what it's done for the Isle of Man. And I can tell you that in the last 25 years, the interconnector has exported 25 billion units of energy to the UK, which is just phenomenal. And not many people know it. And it does it quietly, does it very thoroughly every day for the last 25 years. And what does that mean? It means that the revenue that we've turned over is £230 million. And we've made £80 million from sending electricity here in the Isle of Man to the UK. And that equates to £3.2 million a year, £61,000 a day profit for the Isle of Man. So that shows, you know, it's testament to those politicians at the time, testament to the MUA at the time, or MEA as it was, that we can handle these big infrastructure projects and we can do it well.
Mind you, there were elements to the works that people might argue weren't done particularly well, in as much as there was quite a scandal over the way in which the big capital project, which was the redevelopment of the Polrose power station, as part of that, basically Tindall was misled by the then chief executive of the MUA.
Indeed, and we're talking something over 25 years ago, well before my time, and a completely different financial cycle. But of course, I share your frustration and your outrage in that, along with everybody else who's ever heard of it. I don't believe I'm fit to comment more than that. But it was a scandal then, and it's a sore wound at the moment.
And of course, that inevitably impacts on public trust in relation to any of the works, MUA particularly, but other departments of government, when these sorts of things happen. But as you say, it's quarter of a century ago, and I guess that there are now in place an awful lot more procedures to ensure that that kind of thing can't happen again.
Well, that's exactly right. So a lot of things were put in place, including my position and the vice chair, who's a political member as well. That type of behaviour would not get through the board at the moment, well, never in the future. But you know, it's all very well saying that the harm that was caused then continues till today. And you're right, the public trust is not what it should be. So all I can say is at the moment is that the interconnect is a great success story for us. I mean, the regional sewage treatment system that we're getting on with in Peel is great. The one we did at Moran, which came in on time, under budget, that's another successful story. Now, we don't get everything right, but I know and I can speak absolutely truthfully when I say the people at the MUA are doing their absolute best to make sure they deliver for the people. We never forget at the MUA, we are a community utility. You know, we are for the people, by the people, and we will do our best. That doesn't mean we'll get it right all the time, but by God, we will try.
And then we got on to questioning about the green energy, because the £80 million worth of profit, of course, from the I forget how many billion units you mentioned there.
25 but billion units.
25 billion units that have been exported. The generation of those units counts against our carbon footprint.
It does.
In the same way that imported green energy doesn't count for our
carbon footprint, it has to be that's effectively counts towards the place that it comes from.
Manufactured by fossil fuels in the UK and it's delivered to us via the interconnector, it counts against them but doesn't count against us. That's why these RIGA certificates are really important and are becoming increasingly, you know, what commercial companies want. So yes, it is a two-bladed sword, but, you know, the interconnector is working. It's got another 25 years. We've refurbished it recently. And green energy is here to stay. It's demanded more and more. ESG critical components are required by our companies. And if we're going to be a destination that's going to attract, you know, white-collar business, then we've got to have it.
The demand has increased. I know you. I forget now what the figures were, but it had gone up over the past 3 years to 27% from 11% in 22, 23 to 27% of the total imported electricity in 24, 25. I mean, I'm sure there will be people who will say, well, why don't we just import all the green energy that we need?
Because it's going to cost a lot of money, Phil. I mean, it does not come at the same cost as the ungreen energy, if you like, which is why it's really important that we produce and consume our own energy on our own island.
That was Douglas North MHK John Wannenberg. So what do you think? It certainly is good news that the interconnector has been earning the MUA over £3 million a year over the past 25 years. But has the MUA regained public trust following the secretive financing of major electricity infrastructure works that left us in considerable debt a quarter of a century ago? Also, is there a danger that we are so busy responding to the latest recommendations from international scrutiny of our finance industry that we don't spend enough time checking for the financial crime the new measures are designed to protect us against? Don't forget this programme is available as a podcast. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Goodamayo. Thanks for listening.